understanding of causality, the seeing of how it works, is really a very important central element of Buddhist practice, of Vipassana practice. There's no shortages of quotes from the Buddhist tradition that stress the phenomenal importance of understanding something about the nature of causality, cause and effect, how one thing arises from another. The Dalai Lama said somewhere that more important than understanding emptiness, emptiness being the great central philosophical view and experience of Mahayana Buddhism, more important than that is to understand causality. The Zen Master Dogen stressed that it's essential to have, he called it, a deep faith in causality for us to be practitioners. So there's something very important about causality, not because it's just a law of life, but rather have some understanding and some reference to it is really helpful for the process of liberation or freedom. In the classic model of liberation, where liberation is described as liberation from, freedom from certain qualities, and it seems appropriate that those things are called fetters, that which binds or enslaves us. And the three most difficult of these fetters to unshackle are conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. Earlier in the retreat, I talked about restlessness some. Conceit is a topic which you can give your own talk on. I don't think I'm needed. But ignorance. Ignorance is a tenth fetter. And as a tenth fetter, it's understood to be an act of ignoring. And maybe if we borrowed Freudian terms, it would be called maybe denial. But turning away from, not being willing to look and understand. So it's not just simply an absence of knowing. There would be no end of ignorance then. But rather it's the choosing not to pay careful attention to what's really going on here. And therefore to act out of our ignorance, to act out of our not seeing what's really going on. So, and one of the things we don't pay attention to very well, very carefully, is the causal nexus, the causal chain of how our life unfolds. And it's said that to really see deeply the Four Noble Truths, to really understand very deeply causality, you have to have a mind which is somewhat settled, concentrated, still. It's able to perceive very fine what's going on. Otherwise, the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, the teachings on dependent origination, causality, become just another teaching, kind of a philosophy or a doctrine to be learned. But the point of these teachings is to really see them in your own experience. And one of the things we're doing in developing concentration and mindfulness is so we can see how these things evolve, how these causal nexus works in our experience moment by moment. We can see how there's a moment of sight. In the moment of sight, there comes experience of that's pleasant, it's beautiful. From the beauty of the experience of pleasantness of that sight comes the desire to have that thing. And then from the desire to have that thing, that follows from that desire to have that thing is the various ways in which we try to get it. The plans, the scheming, manipulation, the grasping. And then once we start grasping and manipulating, then that creates a habit, creates a certain identification, a certain sense of this is who I am, this is what I need, this is what's important. And that sense of identification, you can see how these things happen step by step. Remember when I was in Burma, story I like to tell. So halfway through my 8-month retreat there, I walked into my teacher's little house, and I walked in through the door, and I was very mindful, very aware of what's going on. For some reason, I looked at, maybe I always did this, but I looked at his altar as I came in, and there was a new Buddha figure on the altar. It was a really beautiful wooden Burmese sculpted Buddha. And I could see there was a moment of recognition, moment of seeing, recognition, moment of feeling, oh, this is really beautiful, pleasant to look at, the moment of desire, and the moment of scheming, and then the moment of letting go. Just very, very fast. And I think without a mind that's very concentrated and still, these things happen so fast that we find ourselves only mindful at the point of endless scheming. We don't see this, that's actually the causal step there. And the more you can see the causal steps, the relational steps there, conditioned steps, the greater opportunity you have to say, well, that's enough. I just leave it at that. I don't have to go any further with this. We become released from that particular chain as it unfolds. So one of the causal descriptions that the Buddha gave is that of the Four Noble Truths. And again, it said, classically, that only an arhat, only someone who's fully enlightened, really understands the Four Noble Truths. So even a school child can explain what they are. It's pretty simple. I used to be embarrassed when I was a new Zen student, and somebody asked me what the main teaching of Buddhism was, and all I could say to them was the Four Noble Truths. And I was so embarrassed. It was such a simplistic teaching. But it said only an arhat really fully understands what it is. And you can get some sense of that when you get yourself very concentrated and still. You can see the finesse, the subtlety in which the consciousness arises around clinging and suffering. How suffering, you know, is very, very, you know, I think normal people, as if we're not normal. And normal people in this kind of street consciousness wouldn't have a clue the degree to which their mind it operates on suffering and clinging and craving, to the degree that someone who meditates and sees deeply the nature of their mind. So the Four Noble Truths is one of these descriptions the Buddha gave of the causal connections, causal relationships. This leads to that. Or this supports that, or this lays the conditions for something else to happen. And this is, the Four Noble Truths in a sense are, I think, very difficult for people to want to believe. Because it's easier to believe, perhaps, that our suffering is random, or we are unlucky, or suffering comes from other people who do something to us. But it's very difficult to kind of assign the blame elsewhere for suffering. And the mind is able to see very carefully the genesis of that suffering, the desire, the thirst, the addiction, the compulsive thinking and relationships that gives birth to that suffering. You see the suffering and see how it's caused by a particular relationship we have. Then you can't blame it to someone else if you see, oh, actually, I tightened up, I desired, I resisted. Oh, that's what I did right here. So to enter the present moment very deeply, very carefully, allows us to see the subtlety of that movement, of how we create suffering, the causal connections between thirsting, tanha, and our suffering. And so as we do vipassana practice, it comes with, hopefully, an increased appreciation of the present moment, the great beauty and opportunities of the present moment. But vipassana is more than just simply just being present for how things are. It's also being present for what is our response to the present moment. There's always a response. If nothing else, to be mindful is a kind of response. To sit still, upright in the middle of the situation is a response. How do we respond? There's always these two things, our response, the situation, and our response. And the response, our ability to respond is actually very important. Because if the law of causality only said, because of this, that arises, because of what happens in the past, this arises now, we would have no influence on it. Be kind of like the Jains in ancient, still in India, who believe that karma, once it's set in motion in some distant past, is kind of deterministic. You just have to kind of, you don't have any role in kind of working it out. It just kind of works itself out by itself. But the Buddha's understanding of causality was not deterministic. There's certainly a kind of deterministic element of it, that our past actions, our past habits, our past dispositions certainly condition the present situation. But there's always that possibility of us responding in a new way and putting a new spin on the flow of causality. Put a new spin on the chain of conditionality that's flowing on. So that ability to respond becomes very important. As we participate in the flow, the river of change. So we need to understand a little bit about how causality works. And one of the ways, one time to do that is to do it when the mind is very still and very concentrated. And this is one of the reasons why this morning I encouraged you to look at the cause-effect relationship a little bit between the mind and the body and the mind, the smell and what the mind does, the feeling of the body, the sensation of discomfort in the body, what the mind does and responds, the intention to move perhaps in relationship to it, and then perhaps the physical response to the intention, the moving, for example. So seeing these very subtle causal connections, how one thing conditions another. So one of the important causal discoveries of the Buddha was that of the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. And it's been said, at least in the myth of the Buddha's life, that this was the Buddha's pivotal insight, the night of his enlightenment. Perhaps because it's not so easy to really see it, it's easy to explain, but to really see it in our experience, the Buddha chose when he gave his first sermon to give it a simpler description of causality, that of the Four Noble Truths. So the 12 links of dependent origination is the Buddha's description of how suffering occurs and how suffering arises and passes. Because unless you have some understanding of your suffering and the causal conditions that bring it about, then you're probably going to just be relying on some superstitious magic. Some magic's going to do it for you. That if you kind of just, I remember there was one person I talked to some years ago, had done lots of years of Buddhist practice, but the whole, very serious practitioner in some ways, but there was a kind of a magical thinking. The person thought, if I just kind of sit here and put in my time, grace will strike me over the head, you know, just something will happen. You know, just being in the environment, just doing my duty, just putting in the time. There's some magical thinking. But really, there's no magic that's going to do it for us. Buddhas only point the way, you have to walk the path. It requires taking some responsibility to understand somehow this place of response in the present moment and take some look at that ability to respond in the midst of the chain of causal conditioning, the stream and flow of conditionality as it occurs. So there are 12 of these links. Some of you know them quite well. Just to kind of, you don't have to remember them as I speak them now, but just to kind of begin familiarizing yourself with them, I'll go through the list. It usually starts with ignorance. Then karmic formations, dispositions. than consciousness, than name and form, or psychophysical being with name and form. The six sense organs, six sense doors, the contact with the world that arises dependent on the six sense doors, the feeling tone of that contact, pleasant, unpleasant, either pleasant or unpleasant, the desire or craving that arises out of that contact. The becoming, the acting on it, following through on it, developing a habit, developing a predisposition to certain kind of ways, developing an identity, a sense of this is who I am because I'm this way, creating identity, this is what I need. It's a whole area of becoming. And then it gets further. The becoming leads to a birth of a new identity, birth of something solidified, kind of a strong, something has certain momentum to it. Which leads to suffering, sickness, old age, and death. So they go through these. Ignorance is the beginning. The place where we usually begin the discussion of the 12 fold links. And again, it's the act of ignoring, turning away, not noticing what's happening very carefully in the present moment. And of course, that happens at a whole different range of levels. You know, the most gross, coarsest levels to very, very subtle, refined levels that you maybe only see when the mind is quite concentrated. Kind of turning away, not wanting to look and see what's happening. And when we're unwilling to look and see what's happening, and unwilling to look and see what our responses are and what our reactions are and our feelings are inside of us in our contact with reality, then these feelings, these dispositions, these reactive tendencies will still operate. Ignorance doesn't mean that we just shut down and go on vacation. These things operate anyway, then subconsciously. Our dispositions, the learned and conditioned and ways of behaving. So our ignorance is a condition for the functioning of semi-conscious, subconscious conditioning and dispositions, habits of behavior. And these dispositions then kind of set a mood, create a condition for a kind of mood. But in the traditional link, it's called is a condition for the rising of consciousness. And consciousness here, I understand to be kind of the overall mode of apperception, the overall mode in which we're going to take in reality. Kind of the filters, the colored glasses within which we take in the whole show of what's going on. Kind of the wider mode or mood of how we are aware is shaped, is conditioned by our dispositions, our habits, our tendencies, our semi and subconscious reactive modes of being, which we don't even notice are going on because we're paying attention somewhere else. And this mode and mood of awareness, this filter, kind of, then affects how we experience ourselves. And here, Buddha called this nama-rupa. The nama-rupa is not really a psychophysical being, which is sometimes translated that way, because that physical means, you know, kind of some real reality. Nama-rupa means the reality of self as we experience it. not how it might be in reality, but how we experience it. And in the teachings of the Buddha, all we have is our experience of life. And that's all we're interested in. Our suffering is born out of the way in which we experience life. And it'll end when we understand our experience of life. This is why one of the reasons I think the Buddha wasn't very interested in the great religious questions like who am I? Or let's find a true self. Because that belongs to the world of an abstraction. The Buddha kept pointing back to what is your immediate experience? And you won't find the self in your immediate experience. But you will find suffering, you will find the cause of suffering, and the release from suffering. So keep it really simple. Just look at what your immediate experience is. So, nama-rupa, so based on our mood and our mode of our perception of how we carry ourselves in the world, we experience our body, we experience our mind, our mental states, through that filter. In a sense, through that, it arises with that filter. The experience of our being in a body, our experience of being, having a mind, arises together with that mood, that mode of perception. It's very deep. As some of you are seeing, that certain ways in which we've been conditioned as children, perhaps, to see ourselves. Maybe we feel ourselves as being unworthy or unseen. And this kind of goes really deep into us. It's a very kind of almost the nature of how we perceive our body, how we perceive our mind. It isn't so much that we have this mind and body that then does this stuff, but the very ground in which we experience who we are is already colored by mood or mode. And then based on having this experience of a psychophysical of beings, form and body, form and mind, form and mentality, then there's a possibility of perception, of contacting what's going on, of seeing what's going on, feeling and hearing. There arises the six sense doors, the door of the eye, the door of the nose, the doors of the ears, of the tongue, of the tactile sense, and of the mind. So already our perceptions, our sense doors, are kind of from, in a sense, you could say, not originally perhaps, but from practical purposes, from the get-go, our perceptions in themselves are entwined with, maybe subtle, maybe gross, mood or mode of consciousness, of apperception, of sense of self, based on these dispositions and habits and tendencies and mental conditionality that maybe are operating unconsciously, semi-consciously. So then once we have the sense doors there, we often think of the sense doors are neutral. You can just simply hear, and there's such a thing as pure perception. And I think especially in Western psychology or philosophy, there is often a positing of the possibility of a pure perception. And in my understanding of especially the early Buddhist tradition, the Buddha never posited that as a possibility. Just a little bit, you know, interesting. But then with our perceptions comes perceiving, which is called contact. So the contact of our tactile senses with objects, of our eye organ with seeing, our ears with hearing, so forth. So there's the act of perception. Now the act of perception or sensing of awareness. Very simple, you know, basic experience of perception is understood to be have some kind of elemental qualities to it. That has nothing to do with our preferences, nothing to do with our judgments, just in the nature of the experience. Some experiences are pleasant, some are unpleasant, and some are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. The Buddha avoided, didn't use the word neutral. Often it's said in English, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. But he didn't use the word neutral. He said, maybe because neutral is kind of dull, or it's kind of, I don't know what it is, it's kind of lands, it's kind of leads, feels, neutral feels kind of like there's no energy there, or kind of boring, or. But he said, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. But most experiences are either pleasant or unpleasant, right? And the more subtle your sensitivity is, the more you actually see this, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And that's just the way things are. It isn't, you know, for the most part, that's just the way things are. And then based on the pleasant and unpleasant, that lays the condition, lays for the possibility for something else to occur. Without that feeling of pleasant and unpleasant, maybe the next stage wouldn't happen. But it lays a possibility for desire to arise, for craving to arise, which is kind of a shorthand for all the ways in which we cling or grasp or contract. We want, we don't want, we push away, we want more of it, we hang on to it. We enter into a relationship with that pleasant experience or that unpleasant experience. We get entangled with it. More desire, more of it. I wonder if there's more banana bread. Maybe. If I look at the bottom of the compost, I can find a few crumbs. And so, desire arises. You see something beautiful and we want it. And the mind begins following the wanting. So when we start following the desires, following the wanting, participating in the rejection and the resistance and the aversion, then a whole other series of stuff begins to follow. Judgments, criticisms, evaluations, feelings, ideas of good and bad, right and wrong, ideas about how this relates to me and my needs. I'm such a person, so I need to be that kind of way. People won't like me unless, you know, it's one thing, it's unpleasant maybe not to have a shower. But then we have this resistance to it, we label as bad, we criticize it. And this whole world of becoming, identification happens. Maybe people won't like me if I don't shower every day. Boy, it's a room full of people no one likes. Amazing. Wow, I'm in good company at least. So the world of becoming sets into motion and it gets quite, you know, elaborate in there. Desire spawns this world of becoming and ideas, identifications, and who we think we are and what we need. And that all kind of gives birth to something contracted, something solid, something seemingly solid, contracted. And it gives birth to something very pleasant, maybe, perhaps, heavenly realm kind of experience. But it has a nature of arising and passing, has a nature of passing away, of decaying and dying. Which, if we have desire, in this whole sense of becoming and identification, and sense of this is what I need and who I am, and the thing we're holding on to or resisting is going to pass away. it can give birth to suffering. That is suffering. And because the world of impermanence, the world of suffering, the world of contraction, the world of clinging and resistance is in itself a form of suffering, this is where ignorance begins. We don't want to look carefully. We don't want to be present for our suffering. We want to resist it. We want to run away from it. We want to be restless instead of suffer. We want to blame others. We want to pursue desires to. There must be something better than this. So we turn away. We don't want to look at that very carefully. We don't want to recognize it. Which gives birth to ignorance. But that suffering has a momentum to it. Our clingings, our resistances, our ways in which we create a sense of self, the ways in which we defend ourselves, the ways in which we take ourselves as to be a victim, or hold ourselves that way, or the ways in which we hold ourselves to be any kind of way, is not a neutral thing. It's not like a one-time thing, is it? But when there's that kind of holding, it creates traces, it creates momentum, it creates a habit, it creates, you know, and it can be very deeply seated. You know, and the more we do the same action, same kind of identification, same clinging, same, the deeper and deeper that goes. It's like the classic example is like a wagon going over the same road, dirt road, creates a deeper and deeper rut the more often it drives over it. So that momentum is still there, operating, ready to kick in. So if I feel that if I have created an identity or attached to an identity of myself as being someone who is always unworthy, and it's been reinforced over and over and over again by repeating those thoughts and ideas, by interpreting our experience that way, that gives birth, there's a condition for this disposition, a kind of inner disposition, a habit formation of seeing myself that way, which colors the whole mood of how I, of my perception, my awareness, my consciousness of life, of who I am. And it can feel almost like it's in our cells. It must be really true that I'm unworthy because I can feel it in my cells. I can feel my body's that way. I can just feel it. Because it gets so deeply ingrained. It can affect our perceptions, our judgments, and how we see ourselves and see the world around us. It can be almost become self-fulfilling because it's so deeply ingrained. And so we come around to experiencing contact with the world. We're much more likely then to experience contact and see it and relate to it and respond to it based on all this whole disposition of being unworthy. We go into a room of people and it's unpleasant to be around a room of people because of our dispositions. And the response is, let me get out of here. We pull away. And there's cycles of becoming come into place again. So this cycle of suffering goes round and round and round. And the Buddha said, you cannot find the beginning of this cycle of becoming. But certainly we can start noticing how this works. We can notice all the different elements, and the quieter and more concentrated the mind gets, the more subtle we can see these things. And there are various places that are particularly useful to pay attention. Because there is a possibility of liberation. There is a possibility of interrupting or stepping out of that cycle, cyclic process. We're not stuck in it. In a sense, there's hope. And one of the places is at the very place of how the place where we experience the moment-to-moment experience of life, the immediate experience of perception. hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and if you're seeing directly what's happening in the mind, the actual sensations of our experience moment by moment. And we, I think all of us owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to reality constantly interrupting us, getting in the way. Because if it wasn't for that, we'd all be in a loony bin. But constantly, you know, we get hungry, or we stub our toe, or we have to open the door, or someone burps, or we have to breathe. You know, or the zafu hurts a little bit, or there's all these, you know, constantly reality is kind of getting in the way. And reminding us, oh, here you are, kind of interrupting that flow of fantasy, that flow of story making that we tend to live in. And in a sense, what we're doing with Vipassana practice is we're letting reality remind us more often, come back more often. And we start to use that as a starting base to kind of end all the story making and kind of see what's actually happening at the very place we begin, in a sense, constructing desire and aversion and becoming and identification. We can kind of cut through a lot of it. We can cut through a tremendous amount of the spinning of the cycle. You can slow it down dramatically by just coming and start hearing, seeing, smelling. Just this breath, just this in-breath. Just this little pressure at the beginning of the in-breath. Just this feeling of expansion as the in-breath expands. Just this feeling of tautness, vibrating tautness at the top of the out-breath. We train ourselves in the process to see very precisely, in a sense, without straining, to not have any gap in that knowing, just to be there at that level. And then we can catch the feeling tone of that experience. We don't catch it, we just see it, it's kind of like obvious. Oh, this is pleasant, that's unpleasant. Because it's the nature of the experiences themselves. And if it's not clear whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, or it's basically neither, you can see how that might produce confusion, uncertainty. How are we supposed to relate to this? Maybe fear. But contact, we see the contact. We see the felt sense of it, the feeling tone of it, pleasant and unpleasant. And we can see how we then respond to that, how we react to it. Oh, there's wanting more. Just pushing away, not wanting it. Very simple. Desire and aversion. Wanting it to be a certain way arises. And it's that juncture in the cycle where we can let go. One of the places. We can just let it be at the level of feeling tone. Oh, it's pleasant, it's unpleasant. There's no need to make anything more out of it or respond in any kind of way. And we train ourselves, in a sense, to develop the equanimity. Just allow it to be there, just as it is, the experience. We see the desire arise, the aversion arise, and we don't participate in it. We just let it be. Let it be. It might feel like a letting go. Letting go is a very profound practice. But when the practice of mindfulness gets very strong and very stable, you realize that even letting go is too much. All it is a letting be. Letting be. The desire, if you let desire be, it self-liberates. It just doesn't do anything. Because of the becoming, the getting involved with the desire, off we go. Around the chain of causation again. So we leave it there. And when the concentration and mindfulness is strong, we're quite settled, then there's a kind of how to say this. That not letting things be. You understand this practice of non-doing or non-action or non-fashioning. Concentration gets quite strong and equanimous, there's a not-doing. There's not any attempt to tinker with the seven factors of awakening or work with the hindrances any particular way or resist or make anything happen. Not even any letting go. Letting go is a doing. There's a non-fashioning, non-creation, non-doing with anything. Just letting things be as they are. The mind doesn't move for or against anything. It doesn't make anything happen. It doesn't judge. It doesn't criticize. The mind just rests. It just is. In the Vipassana world, this just letting things be, the non-fashioning, perhaps is a close relative to the mind of Shikantaza, the mind of maybe of Dzogchen. Non-fashioning, non-acting, non-doing, just letting things be. But even letting things be is saying too much, if letting things be is a doing. And that's one of the places where we can let go of mind and body. We can let go of this universe. We can let go where the release can happen. When there's this great equanimity, great subtleness, great just not doing, not fashioning. And what will happen to us is that actually that's one very powerful place. But as we do the practice, we begin waking up at all the different points of the cycle of dependent origination. We start noticing how ignorance works, how we are ignoring. We start noticing the ways in which we have dispositions, or the color lenses in which we see things. We start noticing the identifications that we've been holding on to, we're creating anew all the time. We really don't need to be anybody. And we don't need to carry any of ourselves from the past. Who we were yesterday doesn't need to have any bearing on who we are today. We start seeing how we carry self, senses of self, becoming. We see the clinging, we see the creation. So all this can be seen. And hopefully it's all seen with great kindness, with great compassion, great patience. Just mindfulness, seeing more carefully, being mindful. This is how it is. Remembering there's always two things. There's what you're aware of, what has arisen, in how you respond to it. And it's your choice how you respond to it. And the longer your practice, deeper your practice, the greater that ability to respond freely will occur for you. Can you respond with kindness, with compassion? Can you respond with spaciousness? Can you respond just with an act of knowing and noticing? Which is what Vipassana is. Just an act of recognition. Oh, this is what's happening now. That's really the heart of mindfulness. It's probably the most loving thing you can do. Just, oh, this is what's happening now. Just the act of noticing. Oh, this is what's happening. As the mind gets more and more subtle, more and more quiet, it becomes more and more, in a sense, useful to be sensitive to this causal nexus. And maybe you don't have to remember this whole list and look for it all, but very simply be sensitive to, maybe it's not suffering anymore, but but be sensitive to the operation of a very subtle sense of stress or agitation. It still comes from a kind of clinging, kind of becoming. It can be very, very, very subtle. The more refined the mind becomes, the more we can maybe notice the very subtle, refined layers and levels of holding. And it's almost as if awareness itself is a kind of a clinging, kind of a holding. And it gets kind of, you know, very interesting to kind of play in this realm of subtlety, because, you know, this non-fashioning, this non-doing has to be there also. But then you try to do a little bit, you try to look. So the Buddha said that the Dharma is good at in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Practice is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Unless it's not. And who is responsible for that? Not the Dharma. Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. So, what are you doing? What's your doing? So please continue to be quite careful and very respectful and very inspired by what I feel is all of you being quite careful. I feel like all of you are really doing your best. I think that is not always an easy thing to do, this practice. I feel like all of you are really engaged with great honesty and sincerity. And I would encourage you, for these days that remain, it's very, very precious. Don't let the pressure off, because there's always the opportunity to go further. It's wonderful, precious time. Imagine if the Buddha and sat underneath the Bodhi tree the night of his awakening, knowing his retreat was going to end the next morning. And so he said, well, you know, let me think about what I should pack. Don't let up. This could be your night. No, thank you.